A Foreign Country, New Zealand Speculative Fiction, a short story anthology from Random Static Press. This podcast presents two stories from the anthology, Ripley Patton's The Future of the Sky and Miramar is Possum Free by Richard Barnes. The anthology itself contains 22 short stories from New Zealand speculative fiction writers and is available in paperback from randomstatic.net. First up is Ripley Patton's The Future of the Sky, read by Angel Lee McCoy.
The Future of the Sky by Ripley Patton. I grew pregnant under the sky, though no one believed. My father tried to beat the name of the man out of me. Perhaps he hoped it would kill the child. My brother's tools were shame and cruelty. I had dirtied the family name, their reputations. They cared less for the identity of my accomplice than for making me pay. And my mother used love. She said she knew how hard it was, that a man might take liberties, that maybe it wasn't my fault. She said she would help me, so I told her the truth. And she slapped me across the cheek and cried and swore that I was no daughter of hers if I could lie so boldly to her face. For a few days I thought they might disown me, but the weather turned fair. There were crops to harvest, sheep to shear, meals to cook and clothes to wash, and I was a pair of hands they could not spare. I worked, and their glares and barbed words weakened as the days wore on, and my belly swelled. When there was a chance to sneak away, I went to the hill. I lay on my back in the grass and pulled my dress up to expose my own roundness to the sky. I watched the clouds for a feathery form that would separate itself into the shape of a man, with arms and legs and the face of an angel. But he did not come to me again. I had hoped he was different from earthly men, but apparently not. When my time grew near, my mother took me to Henny, the midwife. At first the old woman poked and prodded and asked me when the child had quickened. I stared at her dumbly. "When did you feel it move, Miria? When did it first give you a swift kick in the innards?" "But it hasn't," I said. Henny looked over my belly at my mother, and my mother looked back. "Let me talk with the girl alone," Henny said, and my mother left the room without argument, which scared me more than anything. "Miria, when was the child conceived?"
7 months passed.
"And with what man?"
The strange catch in her voice on the word man made me risk the truth. "A man of clouds," I said, staring at her hard, daring her to believe me.
"A sylph," she said, nodding.
"What? You believe me? What's a sylph?" My questions tumbled over one another. "Why did it choose me? What does it mean that the child inside me hasn't quickened?"
"Slow down, girl. I have your answers, but they only come one at a time," Henny said, clasping her hands in her lap. "A sylph is an elemental, a being of air." She spoke in the storyteller voice she used around the village fire, but I had never heard this story before. "They are guardians of the sky. They shepherd the clouds and direct the lightning. It is said that some day man will fill the sky with filth and poison. The sylphs, if there are enough of them, will be our only salvation. It is also said that in the future man will believe in nothing but himself, that he will make birds of iron to attack the sylphs, and the world will lose all breath." "But what have they done to me?" I asked, running my hands over my belly. "Oh, you're pregnant. Sure as I'm a midwife. But you will not give birth to a child of flesh. The sylphs can beget in the sky by splitting themselves, but it takes a very long time and only results in one cloud child. This way," she said, waving at my rounded middle, "is much quicker and births many more."
"How many more?"
"The sylphs are rare. They take up very little room in the womb." She put her hand to my belly, prodding again. "Sometimes there are 10,
Sometimes there are 50. I looked down at my belly in horror, and Henny hurried on. But you mustn't fear. A sylph pregnancy is always easier than a normal one. Have you felt sick or tired? No, I said, realizing for the first time that I should have. Have you craved strange things to eat, lost sleep, or felt the urge to stand under the full moon? No, I said again. And you've had no quickening. This time it was not a question. No kicks to keep you up at night, no horrible pressure to make you piss every 5 minutes. No. But you have passed more wind, Henny said, smiling. Yes, I laughed. But why me? Why did they do this to me? I asked, thinking of the empty sky, of my family's cruelty, and the horrible weight I'd felt, as if I were the only person in the world. Who knows why the sky rains one place and not another? Henny shrugged, but she looked to the side the way she does when she changes a story, when she softens it for the young ones before they nod to sleep in their parents' laps. I wanted to ask more, but she stood and began issuing instructions. She said I must stay flat in bed, and in a few days I should cut myself where no one would notice. I would use that blood to spot my undergarments, and repeat this over the coming days. With no quickening, folks would be expecting a stillbirth. When Henny was summoned, she would keep them away and help me deliver the sylphs. When I finally went out to my mother, there was sympathy in her eyes, but there was also relief. At home, my brothers' faces told me they thought I had gotten what I deserved. My father's eyes swam with guilt whenever he looked my way, which he tried not to do. My mother fawned over me and crowded me as if my body had become hers. As for me, I was filled with a wonder I could not show. That first night, my mother came to me, sat on the edge of my cot, and said, "Maria, don't fear. I've had a stillbirth child." I looked at her, startled. "It happened twice, before your oldest brother came." She took my hand in hers. "Women seldom talk of such things, for it brings bad luck. But I don't know a woman of the village who hasn't had a stillbirth or miscarriage. Most of them, more than once." "That's horrible," I said. "It shouldn't be such a secret." I had wanted to say the same thing to Henny about the sylphs. Why hadn't she told my parents that I had been telling the truth? Surely they would have listened to the village midwife. Surely they would have believed once they'd seen a host of cloud children fly from my womb. Why was the world so buried in story and secrecy? "You will be well," my mother told me, squeezing my hand, and when she got up there was a determination in the line of her back I had not seen before. The next day women began to visit my sick bed. Old women and young women, married women and widowed women, happy women and bitter women were ushered silently in by my mother. They did not bring flowers or sweet cakes or false words of sympathy. Instead, each one brought me her story, the story of how her womb had betrayed her. They were stories of countless dead children, of grief and bottomless loss. I listened over the swell of my belly, my eyes pooling with tears. I listened so long and hard that I found I could not bring myself to pretend what Henny proposed, to mock these women with my false grief. I did not cut myself or spot my clothes. Instead, while one dear old woman was telling me her tale, I clutched my belly and cried, "A kick! I felt it kick!" She stood in surprise and reached out her gnarled hand to touch me. Her rough palm lay against my smooth, taut skin. We both jumped and cried out in unison when the jolt came, a sudden, unmistakable thump. My lie had been made manifest by some strange miracle. We looked at each other with shining eyes and laughed. Then the old woman ran out, joyful, to tell my mother. A week later I was up on the hill watching the clouds and talking to my belly, while Henny came and stood over me. Her shadow blocked out the sun, making me cold. "What of our plans?" she asked, her lips thin and cross. "They were your plans, not mine. Besides, I felt it kick." "That means there are many," she said angrily. "More than 50, even, to make themselves felt in such a way. It is very dangerous." "I think you're a witch," I said. "Child, you have no idea what you're doing. Then why don't you tell me?" She sighed heavily. She sat down next to me in the grass, and lay back so her arm nearly touched mine. "I'm not a bad woman," she said. "Then why is there a woman in the village who's had 13 miscarriages?" I demanded. "Why has every woman in these parts lost child after child? If you aren't a bad woman, you are certainly a terrible midwife." "No, I'm not. But I do what I must. Without enough sylphs, our future is doomed." "What does that mean? That it doesn't matter if babies die and their mothers cry over them?" "There are no dead babies, you little fool!" Henny laughed bitterly, raising her hands toward the one cloud floating against a backdrop of blue. "There are only sylphs, the saviors of our future, multiplying and expanding and filling the sky." I lay frozen, her words sinking in. "No dead babies, only sylphs. No miscarriages or stillbirths. Only the cloud people." I tried to sit up, but could not. Henny stood and took my arm, leveraging me upwards. When at last I stood, I stared at her dumbfounded, and she nodded at me. "They're all lying?" I asked, indignant anger flaring in me like the sun. "Those women who came to my bed and told me their stories, weeping? It was all a trick? My mother, who slapped me for lying to her face? They've all given birth to sylphs, and they lie about it?" "No, they don't lie," Henny said, looking away from me. "They don't remember. I help them forget. I give them a draught afterwards." "Why?" I asked, clutching my hands and fists at my side so I wouldn't grab her, hit her, shake her. "Why would you give them grief in place of wonder? Why would you give them dead babies when they could be mothers to the clouds?" "It is my calling as a midwife. It is what the sylphs demand." "I don't believe you," I shouted at her. "You're a liar, and those poor women told the truth. You're a witch trying to cover up your black magic." I screamed and stomped off through the grass toward home. I heard her calling after me, pleading and insisting that I didn't understand, that I would put everything in danger. But the sylphs in my belly kicked and jumped, and I knew I was right. Secrets would be exposed. Women would be set free, and I would be the catalyst of a great revelation of the truth. By the time I reached home, I felt unwell. My back hurt, and my hips felt wobbly. When my mother saw me, she rushed me to my cot and made me lie back. "It's too early. I'll send your father for Henny," she said. "No," I snapped. "No Henny." "Why on earth not?" she asked, propping another blanket behind my back. "I don't trust her. She's a witch. If she comes, my baby will die like all the others." My mother started to protest. I pulled her hand to my belly where the sylphs now pounded like hail on a roof. "Does a dead baby feel like this?" "It may be twins," she said, pulling her hand away from the onslaught. "Twins can make for a very difficult delivery." "No Henny." "I'll need help." "Fine. Call the women of the village. Call any of them. Call all of them, and they can take shifts." "A good plan," she said, smiling. "You've brought them together, you know. You've been their solace. Most consider this baby a symbol of the ones they've lost." She did not know how right they were. I was a fool to think there would be no pain. Air is light, and we inhale it with ease, but that is not the same as a horde of elementals battling their way out of your womb. And so I writhed and cried and thought I would die, like every woman who has birthed a child. My mother swabbed my brow, and the village women took their turns helping her, until someone deemed my womb wide open. Then the room grew crowded, for everyone wanted to see my miracle child, my babe come back from the dead as theirs had not. The pain lessened, and I felt an incredible urge to push. My mother moved down between my legs and perched on a stool, her hands delving where I could not see. And then the sylphs were born. I remember every detail of the birth. I have denied myself the mercy of Henny's draught. I remember the smell of the air, crisp and charged with power, as it is before a storm. I remember the feeling between my legs, open and vulnerable, as if any living thing, for the space of a breath, could come and go there as it pleased. I remember my mother's face, intense and focused, her hair whipping violently around her head, her mouth opened in surprise. I remember the sound of a great wind, like the roar of a beast, as the ceiling and wall behind my mother flew backwards into the sky. I reached out my hand to her, but it was too late. My mother and the stool she sat on chased the wall into the heavens, dancing among dark leaves. No, not leaves. Bodies. Women's bodies. I was the only human left in our cottage, but I was not alone. Slipping, spiraling, singing from my womb, came the children of the clouds. They were no mere mist, no wisp of moisture, but solid and white and softer than anything I'd ever felt against my skin. They roiled, formless at first, but soon I saw the glimpse of a face, the hint of a hand, the gentle curve of a backside, babes coalescing in the air around me. An infant-shaped piece of cloud pulled away from the hole, revealing a wedge of blue sky. He flew away, arms spread wide, stretching beyond measure. Others followed, some shaped like children and men and women. A hawk, a horse, a tree, a dragon. The images they took changed and blended, separating and joining again. A castle, a lily blossom, a footprint, the face of my mother. My mother? Where was she? Mother! I cried, suddenly terrified, as the last of my offspring rose into the heavens. But I was the only mother left. I remember how the bodies of the women looked, all lined up inside our cottage in the dust. They looked battered and gray. The men didn't find them all. My mother's body was never found, nor were six others. I remember how Henny came to soothe those crazed with mourning, and I couldn't look her in the eyes. I remember how she glanced up at the sky, and I did too. I remember wanting to deny the beauty of that vision, a multitude of sylphs, ethereal and expanded and distant, dancing amidst the clouds, their shapes sometimes human, sometimes not. They were my children. I remember knowing that grief and joy are two ends of the same pointed stick. Annie had tried to convince me that it wasn't my fault. She thinks she should have told me more, warned me harder. She thinks that even if she'd been there, things would have gone badly. By her estimation, I gave birth to over 100 sylphs. She has never heard of such a thing, and she wants to believe that it means the future is safe. But I have seen the way my father looks at the sky, as if it is his sworn enemy. He trembles when the shadow of a cloud falls over him. He has forbidden me to lie on the hill, as if I'd ever do such a thing again. Henny wants to start telling the women and girls who come to us the truth, now that I am her apprentice. But I know it will make no difference. Our children will not look with whimsy for the shapes in clouds. I think they will build iron birds instead.
And now, Miramar is Possum-Free, read by the author, Richard Barnes.
Jerry Futara took his evening glass of whiskey out onto the deck. He looked out across Heaven's Bay and toward the bright lights of Mount Victoria and Wellington City beyond. It was close to midnight on a cloudless and for once windless evening in the capital. Capital of New Zealand, thought Jerry, should be the capital of the world. His five-storied house sprawled across a hill on the Miramar Peninsula. The narrow isthmus that connected to the rest of the city was heavily gated to stop any undesirables coming over to the exclusive neighbourhood. Apparently, back in the day, a prison and state houses had been built on Miramar. It was an odd notion to Jerry. The government providing houses for people? And how the hell did Miramar hold a prison? The prison he was a part shareholder in engulfed most of Stewart Island. He sipped his whiskey. The full moon was behind him, but there were no stars to see ahead. To the north and west, the glittering lights of Wellington Tower blocks blotted out any starlight. He didn't care. Decades before Jerry had been born, Wellington's hills had been lined with timber-framed houses and lots of greenery. Now a city of 15 million people, terraces of tower blocks worked their way up the slopes and out onto the reclaimed land that filled much of the once wide harbour. It was the price of progress, and that progress had made Jerry Futara one of the richest men on planet Earth. He sipped his drink and thought of the news bulletin he'd just been watching. It was all good. At least, it was to him. Australia was still on fire. No rain had dropped on most of the continent for nearly 4 years now, and forest fires had turned most cities into danger zones. Transporting some of New Zealand's abundance of fresh water across the Tasman made Jerry's shipping business a decent whack of cash. The civil war that had been raging across most of North America was now creeping south. Nobody was producing any food in the States, which is all good for New Zealand agriculture and all good for the people who ship the produce abroad. Yep, the news from overseas was bloody miserable, so Jerry knew he'd be shipping goods all over the world for some time to come. Clean and green New Zealand fed and watered the world, the only genetically unmodified and unpolluted place on Earth. Jerry sipped his drink. It was great to be a Kiwi. Not that he didn't have problems. How was he going to gold-plate his wife's car, for example? As he pondered the issue, he heard a scuffling noise beneath him. He leaned further out and peered down. Below him was a steep slope, descending a couple of 100 metres to the rocky shore of the bay. The moon cast a dim light across some of the bushes and trees, but mostly it was just total blackness. A couple of screaming jets roared overhead and made him look up. They were part of the constant patrols that kept the farming wonderland of the South Island secure. Then something thumped against the side of his deck. Jerry looked out into the darkness and heard voices. "Was that Eat?" said one. "That was a bastard," said another. "Where did it go?" "What's going on down there?" shouted Jerry. "I'll call security." He leaned over to where he thought the voices were coming from. The deck shuddered as a heavy object landed on it. Jerry turned, caught a glimpse of something big, with claws and sharp, sharp teeth, and a nice soft fur coat. Then Jerry was whacked so hard he crashed to the floor, his whiskey glass going flying over the edge. As he slipped to unconsciousness, the last thing he heard was, "Struth, it's throwing bloody glasses at us!" "Madre Dios," cursed Carlos Terra, leaping up and scrambling over the deck rail. "It's got that man!" There was nothing he could do to stop Jerry being dragged over the side of the deck. A blast of bullet fire hammered through the night air, and Carlos dived to the floor. A big man crashed over the rail and waved his gun around. "Did I get it, did I?" he shouted. "Not, Ed, you did not," shouted Carlos back. "He went over the side carrying some guy." "Oh, Christ," said Ed. "We're in the shit now." "What the bloody hell is going on?" cried a woman's voice. Mrs. Futara stepped out onto the deck, wearing a satin house robe. She stared at the small, wiry, dark-haired man with long, hairy arms crouched on the floor, and the barrel-chested, bald guy standing up by the rail. Both had large automatic rifles in their hands, pistols at their waists, and various pouches and straps, with ammo and knives all over their bodies. "Where's my husband?" she demanded to know. "Ah, not to worry, ma'am," said Ed. "Your hubby just went for a walk. We'll be close behind him. We're security." He waved his gun around jauntily. Carlos got to his feet, keeping an eye on Ed's wavering gun. "Yes," he said to Mrs. Futara, with what he hoped was a casual and friendly grin. "She will be right." Mrs. Futara was having trouble focusing and wondered where her drink was. She remembered she'd left the empty glass in the lounge when she'd heard the noise and thought that she'd better go and fill it up again. "Very good," she said. "You'd better keep after him, then. And make sure he's all right. He is Jerry Futara. If anything happens to him, you're both dead men." She turned to go back into what Carlos realised was a very nice house, then paused and looked back at them. "Well, when I say your birthday, Ben, I mean it. When one of our new windows leaked, Jerry had the builder dumped at sea with a load of nuclear waste." She stomped back inside. The two men scrambled to the edge of the deck and climbed over, heading after a thing that had made off with Jerry Shutada. "Hey, Ed," said Carlos, "I thought New Zealand was nuclear free."
"Yeah, right," said Ed. "Miramar is possum free."
It was a point that had been very pointedly made only a couple of days previously, when Carlos had started his first day of work in his newly adopted country.
"There are no bloody possums in Miramar, okay? Got it?"
shouted Henry Mansfield, the head of pest control. Henry was a skinny man with a wild moustache and a wild attitude. He was shouting at a half dozen men seated in the small pest control cabin. Carlos had felt a little out of place among the men. They were all tough and grizzled looking. A couple had beards to their waists and all had very impressive scars. The biggest of them had been the bull-necked and red-faced Australian, Ed, who'd been muttering about being dragged away from the real mission before Hillary had arrived.
"So what the bloody hell are we doing here?" Ed had asked. "There are hordes of the bloody pests up in the hills. Why are we wasting our time in the city?"
"Because some rich prick reckons he saw one," roared Hillary. "Your mission is simple, ladies. Find the possum and kill it."
Carlos raised a hand.
"Do we have traps? Poison?" he asked.
"No, son," said Henry,
stepping over to a large steel cabinet.
"We have guns, lots of them."
With a clang, Henry swung the doors of the cabinet open and revealed several racks of heavy automatic rifles and stacks of ammo.
"Now we're talking," said Ed. "Having to defend rich buggers means we get our hands on the far better stuff than the pop guns we get in the rim of Tuckers."
"Is all this really necessary?" said Carlos. "We are talking about possums, right?"
Several of the men sniggered, including a derisive snort from Ed.
"You boy in the teams, lads," said Hillary, picking up a plastic tube.
He flipped out a couple of rolled-up pictures. He straightened one in front of Carlos. It showed a quite cute-looking possum. The creature had been photographed as it rifled through a picnic basket, and its big brown eyes had a look of, "Who? Me?" about them.
"Here we have the regular pest, imported from bloody Australia, no offence there, Ed, hundreds of years ago. Scientific name? Possumus,
ranted Hillary.
"Now this little bastard caused untold damage to the delicate eco-balance of Aotearoa. So at the start of the century, a concerted effort was made to wipe out the 30 million or so of the furry swine that were polluting our beautiful nation."
Carlos shrugged.
"I guess it didn't work."
Hillary shook his head.
"Oh, but it did. The super genetically enhanced poison, 1081, was unleashed across the country. And Possumus is no more."
He let go of the picture, and it rolled back up and flipped off the table.
"However,"
continued Hillary,
"1081 had an unfortunate little evolutionary side effect."
He grabbed the other picture and slammed it down in front of Carlos. It sort of resembled a possum. A 7-foot tall possum with big gnarly claws and two rows of savage teeth. Its big dark eyes had a look of, "Are you looking at me?" about them.
"This is the super evolved, super aggressive and downright bloody dangerous possum angreus. It is a killer. It eats human flesh, but it also just attacks and dismembers for the sheer hell of it. And at least one of these shits is loose in a suburb populated by the families and children of the rich and powerful."
Carlos was impressed. "We're gonna need a bigger trap."
"Maybe back in the swamps of the Amazon, son, you can get by with traps and poison when you're going after those ratty little monkeys. Here, we prefer to blow their bloody heads off."
Carlos shrugged. "I can handle guns."
"Well, ain't that sweet," said Henry. "How about you and Ed take the first patrol?"
"I don't need a sidekick,"
muttered Ed, as he picked up and started playing with one of the guns. Henry didn't mince his words.
"Carlos here is only with us because immigration has got to put him somewhere. Hopefully, you can get him killed in the line of duty."
The moonlight didn't help much as Carlos and Ed trotted along a narrow path through the bush. Their headlamps were on, in spite of Ed's reservations.
"The buggers will see us a mile off, but I suppose it's better than falling off a bloody hill."
Carlos was in front, although he worried about Ed and his big gun waving around only inches from his head. The tracks of the possum were pretty obvious, even in the dim light.
"Ed!"
he said, after they had been scampering along the trail for about 10 minutes. "That possum is moving fast. She is not going to be right, is she?" "That depends on whether they want to eat Mr. Futara or not," said Ed. "If they are man-eaters, like Hillary said, this Futara guy is already dead, yeah?" said Carlos, feeling for his trigger a little more.
"Maybe not. They need flesh and the bastards take it," said Ed. "But they like their meat fresh. They might keep him alive so they can take him somewhere safe to start chowing down. We might catch him in time."
They arrived at a fork in the track, one path leading up and the other down. Carlos looked at the tracks. There was a confused bunch of marks at the junction, and there seemed to be tracks leading off in both directions.
"Which way?" asked Ed.
"Okay. This will sound stupid, but this is what the tracks are telling me," said Carlos. "Our first possum seemed to have been met by a bunch of friends, and they split up. I guess two went up, and two went down. Who knows which bunch has Mr. Futara?" He looked back at Ed, expecting some insult about possums being so clever. Ed nodded.
"The sneaky bastards. They want us to split up and leave one of us into a trap."
"These are possums, right?" said Carlos. "They might be giant possums, but they're still just animals. They won't be laying tracks on anything." Ed ignored him and peered into the darkness along each path.
"I'll take the down trail," he edged past Carlos. "Shoot anything you see. If I hear shots, I'll come running. You do the same."
He stomped off down the trail and into darkness. Within moments, the only thing Carlos could see of Ed was the faint glow from his headlamp. A moment later, he turned a corner and was gone. Carlos brought his rifle up and started up the track. Jerry woke when he was dumped onto the ground. A tree root stabbed into his back and he rolled over, his face going straight into the spiky embrace of a gorse bush. He wriggled back and started to reach up to rub his eyes, but realized his hands were tied behind him.
"Who's there?" he called. "Who's behind this?"
His face felt puffy, and he could only open one eye. There was not much to see but darkness, with a few great strands of flax lined by moonlight. A giant, furry shape waddled into his field of view and lowered its head to look at Jerry. The massive possum bared its teeth and gave a hissing sort of growl. It reached out with a large, gnarly, clawed hand and gave Jerry a not-too-gentle slap on the cheek before shuffling back. As Jerry followed its movement, he could make out another two or three of the giant possums. There was no sign of a human anywhere. Jerry shuffled and twisted round. His ankles were tied too, but he was just about able to push himself up to a sitting position. Behind him was more flax and gorse, clinging to the steep hillside. In front was a narrow strip of ground before more wide, ragged flax leaves. The possums were crouched a few feet away and were peering through the flax leaves down the slope. This was deranged. How could someone train possums like this? Being kidnapped was a shock, but the simple fact was, he was rich, very rich. Jerry had always assumed that kidnapping just wouldn't happen in New Zealand, but here he was, tied up and getting dragged away. If the human kidnappers were around, he would have started bargaining. Yes, he was terrified, but Jerry's success came from hard business sense, and he believed everyone could be dealt with somewhere or other. But there were no humans, only huge, mutant possums. Carlos moved fast, but carefully. He had fought in jungles before. He told immigration that he'd been in pest control, but that was not entirely true. It was a war zone back in Brazil, so he was used to looking for ambushes and traps. The trail twisted around, mostly leading up, but with plenty of shifts and changes. Whenever he had to turn a corner or move into an unseen space, he slowed up and surveyed the area. Below in the darkness, he could hear Ed shouting as he thundered through the bush. That kind of thing would get a man killed back in the Amazon. Sometimes he flattened himself to the damp ground. Sometimes he looked to find a handhold to hoist himself up. Always he tried to make sure that he would be able to see what was around the corner before what was around the corner could see him. After maybe 10 minutes, he turned again, staying very close to the edge of a broken concrete wall. He peered round and saw a possum, a big possum, crouched on the other side of a concrete slab. The path had come to the edge of a ridge, and beyond the slab was just silvery moonlit sky. The black shape of the possum stood out against it. He raised his gun and set the sights on the possum's head. He looked through the scope and saw its nose twitching. The possum would be able to smell Carlos, so there was no element of surprise. But the animal was clearly not worried by him. Perhaps it had no understanding of the threat, but Carlos was not so sure. That thing, or something like it, had dragged Jerry Futara away. He could shoot it now, blowing its bloody head off. But if it had dumped Jerry elsewhere, there might be no way of finding the man tonight, and who knows what state Jerry could be in. And, if he was right about the tracks, and Carlos was rarely wrong about such things, there should be another possum somewhere nearby. He lowered the sights and was about to fire a scaring shot at the concrete when the thunder of automatic fire echoed up from below. He jerked back instinctively, peering down the slope to see if he could make out what was happening. As he turned his head, his face met a hard possum fist coming the other way.
Ed charged down the track. At every corner he jumped round with his finger poised on the trigger and bellowed a roaring challenge. "Come on, you bastards, bring it on! You fucking meat, you know that? You fucking dead meat!" There was no point in subtlety with these bastards. Hard brute force was the only way. He was glad the path had spit. The little spick would have just got in the way. Poisons? Traps? True. Ed had been surprised when Carlos had just picked up the heavy weapon and checked it out with an obviously professional eye. He'd just assumed that Greasy Sob wouldn't know a shotgun from his own arsehole. But all this slow tracking was a waste of time. No point messing around trying to be quiet. The possums could smell them miles off. So might as well make them know you are coming and were ready. He flew round another corner and saw a dark shape leap across the path. Moonlight seemed to flash off one eye. The other was covered by an eye patch. "At last!" roared Ed. He fired as the possum disappeared into the bushes. The leaves and branches exploded into shreds, and Ed ran after that possum. Jerry heard the gunshots. Maybe it was the men he had heard just as he'd been grabbed. He'd been to America. He'd had the training. If you were kidnapped, there was no point staying quiet. The further away from help you got you, the worse trouble you were in. "Help!" he screamed. "I'm down here!" More gunshots followed. The big possum who had slapped Jerry earlier turned and hopped over to him. Its teeth were bared and its eyes wide. A growl was rumbling in its throat, while a thin whine slipped through Jerry's lips. The possum grabbed him by the throat and hoisted him onto its shoulder. With a quick bound, the possum was jumping up the slope while Jerry bounced around on its back, unable to move and too scared to scream. Carlos rolled with a blow, spinning away and trying to get around the wall. He brought his gun up to use against the other possum if it tried to get at him. The possum who'd hit him moved fast. Spinning with the Brazilian, its claws found the big gun and pulled it from his fingers. Carlos kicked out and managed to shove himself away, rolling back over the concrete slab. When he sprung to his feet in a crouch, his back was to empty space, and in front were two big, nasty-looking possums. The one on his left, who had smacked him in the face and pulled the gun away, had an eye patch across his left eye. "I should have known Ed would take the path going down," growled the eye-patched possum. It was hard to make a comparison, but when the possum bared its teeth but kept its jaws together, Carlos was pretty sure it was grinning. "Yeah, I can speak, and yeah, I know Ed." There were more gunshots from below. "Sounds like he's making trouble. But don't worry, mate, he won't make too much more, believe you me." "What have you done, Mr. Futara?" said Carlos, glancing behind. It was a sheer drop, a cliff face covered in gorse. To Carlos's left, a good 20 meters away where the cliff stopped at a corner, there was a stumpy tree poking out. Eyepatch noticed where Carlos was looking. "A nice agile possum will be able to scamper down that slope and wouldn't even need to grab that branch. Stumpy little bloke like you might have a bit more trouble." Carlos started to reach towards his pistol. Eyepatch raised the big rifle. "We can talk, we can kidnap billionaires, and we know how to use guns. Ain't science wonderful?" "What do you want with Mr. Futara?" said Carlos. "Maybe I can help." Carlos took the snorting wheezes that came from both possums as cynical laughter. "Don't worry about Mr. Futara," said Eyepatch. "We need him alive. You and Ed, on the other hand, will be going back in pieces. Holding a nice, rich, important man as a hostage will send a big message to you humans. And dropping the body parts of a couple of grunts like you and Ed on the barbecues of the rich and famous will tell everyone that Miramar is definitely not possum-free." Eyepatch made a sniffling grunt noise, and three more possums appeared. One crouched on the battered concrete wall, another was clinging to a tree, and the third popped up at Carlos's feet. A heavy, sustained burst of gunfire echoed up from somewhere below them. Eyepatch barked. The other four possums leapt towards Carlos. Carlos jumped off the slab.
Ed sprayed bullets into the undergrowth and rushed after them, paying little heed to the darkness or the surface below his feet. He crashed through flax leaves and ignored the sharp spikes of gorse. In his headlamp, he caught the odd glimpse of fur as the possums scampered away. The bloody animal was moving fast and twisting and turning a lot, but Ed didn't care. Every now and then, the possum would leap across the path, changing direction again. But every time, Ed spotted the eye patch, and every time, he matched the possum's move. That bastard animal was going to die. His left foot hammered onto a rotten branch, his right foot found nothing at all, and Ed tumbled forward and suddenly down. With a furious roar, he toppled down the slope, trying to grab something with his free left hand while keeping a firm grip on his rifle with his right. Gore scratched his bare shoulders and branches thwacked him in the face. He hit firm ground in a clear hollow and rolled to one knee with his gun swiftly in both hands and ready to fire. The possum was there, and it had an eye patch. A moment later, its upper body was torn apart by bullets.
"Gotcha, you furry bastard!" Ed shouted. "You ran from bloody Australia, but I got you in the end."
Another possum emerged from the bush. It also wore an eye patch. A second jumped down, again with an eye patch.
"What the fuck is..."
Ed didn't complete the sentence because a heavy, furry bulk slammed into him from behind. A moment later, three possums were all over him, ripping his gun away and punching, kicking and biting. A series of sharp slaps brought Jerry round again. It was still unpleasant, but not such a shock when he was greeted by the snarling face of a giant possum. Behind the possum, he could see the sky growing brighter. It had been a hell of a night, he thought. The possum growled and moved back, allowing Jerry to have a better view of his surroundings. They were on a grey, sandy beach. Across an expanse of water, there was the dark silhouette of hills. He realised where they were. They were still on Miramar, but on its east coast, looking across the entrance to Wellington Harbour. As he looked around, another big possum dropped down to the beach from the cliffside above. It threw a big gun to one side, and then hauled something off its shoulder onto the sand just near Jerry. The something was another man, a big guy with a scarred face. As he looked at him, the man's eyes opened, spotted Jerry, and winked. Then he went back to feigning unconsciousness. There was a series of growls and barking noises from above, and a few moments later, a couple more possums thumped down to the beach. One was the biggest he had yet seen, and wore an eye patch. It dropped another big gun next to the first.
"Morning, Mr. Futara," said Eyepatch.
It shuffled closer, giving the fallen man a hard kick as he passed.
"Jesus Christ," stammered Jerry. "We're talking possum."
"We talk. We kidnap. We ransom. We fight. Oh boy, do we fight."
"I'm a rich man," said Jerry. "I can help you."
Eyepatch nodded.
"You sure will help us."
"What do you want?"
"It's going to work like this. First, we'll dismember Ed here, then we'll cut off your ear," said Eyepatch.
But what? Why?"
"Your ear will be delivered with a demand that all hunting of possums is to end," said Eyepatch, "and that the Rimutuckers are to be given over to the Possum Nation. As for Ed here, we'll be chucking bits of him all over Miramar to send a message that the Possum Nation is to be feared."
"You don't need to send me the message," said Jerry.
"Maybe not you," said Eyepatch. "But the authorities only sent two men to find the possum that we made sure someone spotted in Miramar. I don't think they're taking us seriously."
"Two men?" said Jerry, looking at Ed, still face down in the sand.
"The other one decided to jump off a cliff," snorted Eyepatch.
It turned and barked at one of the other possums, who shuffled over with an axe gripped in its claws. Eyepatch nodded at Ed. Axe Possum chomped excitedly and reached for Ed.
"Take his leg off at the knee. That shall wake the bastard up."
Ed grunted as his leg shot out and kicked Axe Possum hard in the scrotum. The possum doubled over and Ed rolled, grabbing the axe. With a roar, he slammed the blade into the possum's head. Jumping to his feet, he swung another and caught it in the shoulder. The possum went down with a howl.
"Hold it there, Ed," barked Eyepatch.
Jerry watched Ed back up, his teeth bared and the axe twitching in his hands.
"Stupid bloody human," said Eyepatch, "bringing an axe to a gunfight."
The gun looked insane in the hands of a possum, no matter how big and nasty the possum. But then, Jerry had been kidnapped by possums who were demanding rights and land. How much more insane did things get?
You killed my wife, you stinking animal, said Ed. And gun or no gun, I'm going to rip you in half. She died in a forest fire, snarled Eyepatch. Which you started, shouted Ed. You are ripping up our land. You don't even know how many of our mob, how many of my children, brothers and sisters you've killed. We need the land. You're in the way. We get you out of the way. I don't care how genetically modified you are. There are humans and there are animals, and you are dumb fucking animals. Maybe, said Eyepatch, but I'm a dumb fucking animal with a gun. He raised the rifle. A loud whooping cry rang out. A dark shape flipped from a stumpy branch growing out of the cliffside. It swung down to another bush, somersaulted to a jutting rock, and whirled out from the cliff face. With 2 feet first, Carlos slammed into Eyepatch and sent him flying. Both the possum and Carlos rolled onto the sand. Carlos had the gun. Eyepatch leapt up first. Gotcha, you possum bastard! Roared Ed, and the axe span through the air and hit Eyepatch in the one good eye. Eyepatch took one step back, then keeled over, dead. There was a burst of gunfire, and Ed jerked back. He toppled onto the sand just near Carlos. The top of Ed's head was blown away, but his expression was still one of furious hate. Carlos fired back at the possum with the gun. He hit the barrel and it spanned from the animal's hands. The possum looked at the gun in Carlos's hands and scattered, bounding up the cliff face. In moments, they were gone, vanished into the undergrowth. Wearily, Carlos trudged over to Jerry. He pulled out his knife and cut the billionaire's bonds. How the hell did you swing down like that? Said Jerry. The wiry Brazilian looked wiped out. I've got my genes spliced with monkey DNA. Are you serious? Said Jerry. Carlos nodded. Over in Brazil, they figured that the only way to deal with an enemy that was faster, more mobile, and able to use every part of the rainforest was to make the soldiers able to do the same things. He's pretty mad, he continued, noting the look in Jerry's eyes. But when you've been living like a dog in the slums, it's a small sacrifice to escape. But over here, it's like over there. We think we're just tearing up the forest and wiping out animals. But it was our pollution and the experiments that changed the monkeys and the lemurs and the jaguars in the Amazon. They're not stupid. They're fighting back. I couldn't bring myself to kill intelligent creatures, the tribes and families. I can't do it here either. Jerry got up and walked over to Ed's fallen body. He pulled the pistol from its holster and glanced up at the cliff, expecting more possums to come out fighting. Maybe the animals are getting smarter, pal, said Jerry, but we've got the technology. We'll win in the end. Carlos threw his arms up in despair. Sure we'll win. We'll wipe out every bit of natural earth left. Then what will we have, eh? Mother Dios, Mr. Futara, what the hell are we going to do? Jerry started walking along the beach, heading north to where he knew there was a road and houses. Carlos trudged along behind him, keeping hold of the big gun. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, said Jerry. Move house. Out of bloody Miramar.
A Foreign Country, New Zealand Speculative Fiction, is available from Random Static Press in paperback format at randomstatic.net. Or you could ask for it at your local bookstore. It features stories by Philip Armstrong, Richard Barnes, Claire Brunette, Anna Caro, Matt Cowans, Bill Doreen, Dale Elvey, J.C. Hart, Paul Haynes, Miriam Hurst, Tim Jones, Susan Kornfeld, Juliet Marillier, Lee Murray, James Norcliffe, Ripley Patton, Simon Petrie, Brian Priestley, Marama Salasano, Lee Sentez, Janine Sowerby, and Douglas A. Van Bell. I'm Matt Cowans. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the stories and that you do check out the rest of the anthology. And please do feel free to share this podcast with anyone you think might be interested. Thank you for listening. Ka kite anō.